Send your wildlife recordings, questions and observations on WhatsApp to 087 708 7031.
You can also visit the website anytime you like. It's rte.ie/Mooney. We do want to hear from you. Text 51551. In studio today with me is Niall Hatch, as always. How are you today, Niall? Enjoying the summer weather?
I am, absolutely. Lovely to have this glorious weather for a change. So a lot of very sunburned looking people going by when I was coming in here today. So hopefully there won't be too much red skin around this evening.
Actually, you make me think of something there. What about sunburnt birds? Does it ever happen?
Well, birds, of course, they're covered in feathers. So the feathers do protect their skin. If they did have a bear patch there, then they could indeed get sunburn. But actually, many birds have dark skin underneath their feathers, and that would give them some protection from the sun. I know that one of the animals that most suffers from sunburn, apart from humans, is pigs. Pigs have a problem with sunburn. So humans and pigs, they're the two species that get it the worst.
Let's say hello to Aina Nilan, who's in Kilrush in County Clare. Aina!
Hello, Derek. How are you doing? I'm down here in County Clare, and the summer is here too. And the birds of the summer are here. The town is full of swifts screeching around the place. Now, I know you're going to be talking about swifts tomorrow night
we
on
are.
The air. But apparently, there wasn't all that much records of swifts in Kilrush until I rectified the situation by telling Niall there's loads of them down here. So, you know, people may have swifts all around the country, and they assume everybody else knows, and it's not necessarily so. And when I mentioned it to the people at Kilrush, they all said, oh yeah, of course we have swifts here. We've always had them. They nest in St. Senan's, they nest in the Protestant Church. They're welcome visitors here. So there you are now. Indeed, Kilrush is as lovely as ever.
Well, I was in Belfast at the beginning of last week, and there are swift boxes on some of the buildings in Belfast.
Yes, Belfast is well known for its swifts, and there's been lots of work done there with the Northern Ireland Swift Group and others who've put up these boxes and who monitor their populations. And this is something we're seeing now all over the island of Ireland. There are lots of local groups and bird returning branches and other tidy towns groups getting together, putting up these nests boxes for these birds, because one of the big problems they have, it's a lack of suitable nesting spaces. Modern buildings have fewer nooks and crannies where they would nest, and swifts really only nest inside high roof spaces in buildings, in church spires. And when renovations happen and when new building faces are put up and new buildings are being constructed, very often the swifts aren't thought of at all, and that would be a real pity. So we're rectifying that, and it's really good to see so many communities taking them to heart.
Let's not hang around, let's get out and about now with Terry Flanagan, who has his eye on nature for us. Terry, where are you today?
Well, Derek, I'm on the trail of orchids. Did you know that there's somewhere between 25,000 and 30,000 species of orchids worldwide?
Ooh.
And of course, people are saying there's no orchids in Ireland. Well, guess what? We have 30 native species now, and they're in flower at the moment. And where am I, you asked? Well, I'm along the banks of the Royal Canal, between somewhere close to the Dublin-Kildare border. It's beautiful here. The birds are singing. I'm watching the swallows. Oh, and I seen some swifts earlier on. You mentioned swifts because I know they're on tomorrow night. Ain't has just said it. But there's also lots of swallows here. But getting back to the orchids, the one thing about the orchids, they're a little bit difficult to find because you have to look for them. You have to get down to them. And the key rule for orchids is don't pick them. Don't try and take them home. Don't try and plant them in the garden because they won't grow. The golden rule is don't pick it up, get down to it. Now, when you get down to the orchids, and there's a train going by, you'll probably hear that too. Yourself.
I can't. You sound a bit like a rapper. Get down on it. Get down to it, Terry. Whatever you're up to yourself.
No, get down to the orchids. Don't pick it up. Don't take it home to your garden. Now, the word orchid, it comes from Greek, orchis, meaning, do you know, Derek?
I don't.
It means testicle. And in Irish, it's referred to as the mogerlian, also meaning testicle. And it has to do with the shape of the tuber, particularly of the species that's here at the moment in flower. That's the early purple. And what it has a pair of tubers underground. And one is hard and swollen and the other is soft and wrinkled, and hence the name. Now, when you get down close to this particular species here, and you smell it, you might think, oh, all flowers have a lovely fragrant smell. But this particular species, the early purple, it actually smells of tomcat's pee, believe it or not. And there's another one here in flower at the moment, the pyramidal, and that's got a foxy smell. And I'd have to say about the orchids, they're the most mysterious of all wildflower families. Not only the life cycle, but the flowers. They're what we refer to as bilaterally symmetrical. In fact, they look somewhat similar to a human face, which is different to most other flowers. And they have the tiniest seeds in the flowering kingdom. Believe it or not, the seed of an orchid, it's only about the size of a single speck of dust. And it's not able to carry enough food for the seed to germinate. So what it does is it lives symbiotically with a colony of fungus. It's a kind of a mat of fungus that's found in the ground. And these native Irish orchids, you usually find them in kind of undisturbed localities, like where I am here at the moment, where the soil, it's low in nutrients and there's little competing vegetation. Now, what the fungus does, the fungus feeds the seed, it provides it with essential nutrients, and later on the fungus feeds off the sugars in the root tips. So you know the old saying, Derek, you scratch my back and I'll scratch yours. Well, anyway, probably the most vivid Irish orchid has to be the bee orchid. And what it looks like a female bee on the plant. And believe it or not, the petals, they actually smell like female bees. So all of a sudden along comes the male and he says, uh-oh, here we go. And what does he do? He tries to mate with the bee, which is really the flower of the plant. What happens? He becomes covered in pollen. He flies off then to the next bee orchid. And guess what happens? Bingo, pollination. And the scientific term for this type of pollination is referred to as pseudo-copulation. But the unusual thing in Ireland, Derek, is that bee orchids are mostly self-pollinated. Now, if people want to go and see orchids or if they want to go and look for orchids, there's lots of places around the country they can go to. Like where I am here, for instance, at the canal. It stretches for miles and miles and miles. And if you slow down when you're walking, you'll find them. But I know Aine is down in Clare. There's lots of them down in the Burren. I know I saw lots of them in flower, the early purples in flower there last week. The Raven in County Wexford is another good place. Or any meadows, or another really great place in Dublin is the North Bull Island. And it's also a fantastic place for what we know as the marsh helleborine. And we get them in those in the sand dunes. Now, yesterday I was speaking with an old friend, Father Jackie O'Connell from Cara. Anybody down that part of the country will remember Jackie. He was the parish priest there for many, many years. He's an avid amateur botanist and he's a particular interest in orchids. And about 5 or 6 years ago, he found a new population of hundreds of green-flowered helleborines in County Kildare. In fact, it was the largest number recorded in either Ireland or Britain. So, realistically, the numbers of orchids throughout the country are probably under-recorded. But going back to the bee orchid, there was a scheme set up in Middleton, County Cork, a few years ago. It was under the auspices of the All-Ireland Pollinator Plan. And it led to 363 individual bee orchids growing there last year throughout the town, on the streets, on the paths and so on. So schemes like this and the idea of not mowing or reduced mowing, when you do it, it's amazing to see what will grow. So we're going to head off here for another little bit of a walk along the canal to see how many more species we can find. But it's a beautiful day here. It's not terribly sunny, but it's very, very warm. And there's lots and lots of wildflowers to see.
Orchids really are remarkable plants. I wish they were better known within Ireland because they're very beautiful to look at. And when you get close to the flowers and the individual florets on them, you realise, gosh, these things really are orchids. They have this most amazing intricate patterning and colouring, and it's really, really gorgeous. And they're also very good indicators of the biodiversity of the area because they're plants that don't respond well to disturbance and they don't respond well at all to the use of fertilisers on land. So they'll really only grow in land which hasn't been extensively farmed, and from that we can see that there's a whole plant community that builds up around them. They're very, very important. And of course the symbiotic relationship that they have with the fungus in their roots is why they're so hard to cultivate, and why when they're lost from an area, simply transplanting them into a new area, you know, for if a road is being constructed or something and they have to be moved, why if it's not done by experts who really know what they're doing, it's not going to succeed. Now, a lot of people think of orchids as looking very beautiful but not having much by way of commercial use. But actually, one of my favourite orchids of all is one that has a beautiful smell, and that's the vanilla plant. Vanilla, a lot of people don't realise, is actually a member of the orchid family, and it's one now that's commercially cultivated and obviously is used to flavour ice cream and just about everything else, that lovely sweet taste and smell that it has. But I'd love seeing the orchids around Ireland. As you said, Terry, the Burren, a remarkable place for them, again, because it's undisturbed ground. And I'm sure Aine must have had lots of encounters with orchids over the years. Do you have a favourite, Aine?
Yes, indeed, I do have a favourite indeed. You were talking about the bee orchid there, but there's a fly orchid as well. And it actually looks like a fly. So it's the same carry-on, really. Some poor, unfortunate, male-deluded fly thinks it's a female, and then having tried to do a mating and not succeeded, instead of going home to his mammy and having learnt by his mistake, he flies off to another one and carrying the pollen. And not only does Terry said he gets covered in pollen, but in fact in the fly orchid situation, that the two stamens hit him on the head. So when he's trying to mate with the alleged fly, the two stamens are at the front with the pollen, they hit him on the forehead and he's covered in pollen. just there. So when he comes to the next one then and tries to get into the right position, he has his head with the pollen on it ready to fertilise the female one. And they tend to be in more acid soils, because you were speaking of the burn, and the burn, of course, is alkaline soil. It's limestone, as we all know. And quite a lot of the orchids are in areas where the soil is limey. So Terry there along the canal, he's on an esker. Eskers are limestone areas. The burn, of course, is limestone. And of course, if you're by the seaside, your soil there is also full of seashells, and therefore it's very limey. But, you know, the more fields are ploughed, the more things have nitrates and stuff added to them, the more the old meadows are ruined and destroyed, then the orchids are gone. So they are, as you said, an indicator species of old grassland that hasn't been interfered with, that hasn't been touched in any way. And as a consequence, not only then will we have the orchids there, which people like, but there's all sorts of other things in that particular area as well, undisturbed earthworms, undisturbed other plants growing among the grasses. And the grasses aren't being such a bully, because the more you add nitrates, the more you add fertilizers to soil, this gives the greedy grasses the oomph, if you like, to keep going, and then they bully everything else out, and as a consequence there's no space for your other wildflowers. So I suppose in a way we can look at our orchids and think, well, you know, they're the champion ones, they're the ones that carry the sort of the flag waving ones. And it was interesting when to see Terry down on his hands and knees sniffing them, saying they smell like tomcat's pee. God, I wouldn't be going around smelling tomcat's pee, but obviously the insects that they're wishing to come and pollinate them are not necessary attracted to nice fragrances the way other flowers are, or the way sometimes honeysuckle and things put out perfume at night to attract a particular moth.
So my name is Michael Doe. I'm recently retired as a tour guide at the Dunmore Cave.
They have evolved with insects in order for pollinations to take place. And of course, these are all very small, lovely orchids, tiny little things, really, when you compare them to the ones that people like me, Fadoe and I, used to wear in our goonies when we were going off to Deb's balls and the like. And these were, of course, great, big, enormous orchids that were taken in from South Africa and from rainforests, really. I mean, obviously, they didn't fly them from the rainforest to my goona, but at the same time, those big, showy ones are those kind of epiphytic ones that grow on trees. And of course, get their symbiotic relationship from there, and they're the ones that then cultivate for people to wear. And I see. In fact, you can even buy them as potted plants for your house now. These big white and orchids, but they're showy, they're blousy, they're you know, showing off too much. You know, a lovely place. I know I'm in Clare, but if I were further north, if I was up in Galway, or I was up in Mayo, or I was in Donegal, I'd be in the Machairs. And the Machairs are sort of flat sand dunes, if you like. And the wind and the conditions are so severe that the grass doesn't grow very well, and the wildflowers get a great go. And you'd know those places, Niall, for choughs, because that's one of the places where choughs really survive and are able to probe the short grass for the invertebrates that they feed on. But the orchids there can be magnificent, and they start off with the early purple and they go right through to the helleborines that Terry was speaking about, those lovely white orchids that you get in the autumn time. But there's all sorts. I mean, like the way you have the roses and the different wild roses, and you have the splitters and the lumpers, people who make loads of subspecies and people who lump them all together. The actual orchids were done in the same way, and there was a botanist, O'Kelly, and there's an orchid called after him, you know, Dactylorchis O'Kellyi, because it was a particularly beautiful white one, a burn one, that people really want to see to this day, because it seems to be around still. And yes, it's probably a subspecies of one of the other Dactylorchises, but still, because it has this beautiful white colour, and normally that particular one would be purple, he got his moniker on it. So maybe I should keep my eyes open. Maybe I'll find an orchid that can call after me. Wouldn't that be something, Niall?
Oh, absolutely. I think it's an honour you richly deserve, Aina. There certainly should be a Neil Lowney or something, orchid species. I know that certainly when it comes to orchids, they often hybridise as well. So you can find hybrid plants around that makes identification quite difficult. So orchid identification is a big challenge. However, they have a big advantage over my usual group of wildlife that I look at, i.e. birds, because of course the orchids don't fly away. So you can really study them in detail and get very up close and personal with them to work out all the differences.
Well, look what you've started, Terry Flanagan. Are you going to continue on your evening? Are you going to continue walking along the banks of the Royal Canal looking for more orchids?
I certainly will, Derek. But before I go, I must tell you that here I am, or here I was, I'm standing up now, but here I was sitting down on the ground sniffing these orchids, people walking by, there I am with my recording material, I'm talking into a microphone, I'm here on my own, and people are looking at me and say, what's wrong with that chap? There's something wrong with him. But the orchids that we find here in Ireland, they are small, but they're absolutely beautiful orchids. I know when people go to the botanic gardens and that, and they look in the botanic gardens and they go to the orchid house and they see these magnificent orchids, they're grown from the trees and they're grown from the ceiling, they're hanging down. But I would have to say that our orchids are spectacular, and to see them at this time of the year is, it's really, really beautiful to see them. Walk along the canal, slow down, don't be trying to get home as quickly as possible, and look to see what's there, and you're going to see these orchids. The early purples are here and the pyramidals are here, and I know at the moment the bee orchids are out at the moment, so there's none here, I've seen none here, but I do know they're around the country. So get out there and have a walk and enjoy them.
Terry, thank you very much indeed. We'll talk to you next week. Now, we've been asking you to send your observations and wildlife queries via WhatsApp to the programme. The number is 087-708-7031. And you've been doing that in your droves. Here's an example.
Hi, Derek. This is Gustavo Solat, and I have a question. I have been watching a family of foxes in a private site near my residence. Very few people have access to that site, and those fox had cubs, two cubs, couple of weeks ago. And this week I found one of the cubs dead in the middle of the site. The legs were wide open as if it had some sort of kind of, you know, impact against them, and it looks like something was feeding off the belly of one of these cubs, could be a magpie or a rat or something like that. But the question is, someone mentioned that the cub could have got out of the site and maybe it was hit by a car. But the question is, how did it make it back in if that was the case? Like, could one of the adult foxes have brought the cub back into the site? A bit of a mystery there. So I was wondering if either you or any of the experts in the panel have any thoughts as to how that could have happened. Thank you and have a great day.
Thank you very much indeed, Gustavo. Aina, any suggestions? Could the adult have brought the poor cub back into the site, do you think?
Well, the adult certainly could. Adult foxes do sometimes move dens, and the female fox will carry the young foxes by the scruff of the neck from one place to another so that she gets them there safely. So a female fox carrying a cub by the scruff of the neck would not be unknown indeed. But he says he thinks it might be a car. I didn't quite catch. He was saying it had its legs apart. Did he say it had been cut open, that its stomach had been cut open?
No, he reckons that something was feeding from it. So it was dead on the ground, either where it was knocked down. Perhaps he thinks it was knocked over, and then maybe the adult brought it back into the site, left it there, realised it was dead and moved on. And then maybe a rat or other birds or something else were feeding from it then, you see, and start pecking.
Because I know buzzards will kill young foxes. And certainly my own brother in County North County Dublin, he had buzzards nesting, and he said that in fact when the cubs were very small, they were caught and taken by the buzzard, and he found actually the skull of one of the foxes, and it was so young that the eyes hadn't changed. Foxes have amber eyes, but when they're babies and when they're young, they have blue eyes. And this thing with blue eyes was an amazing. He didn't know what it was, but it's blue eyes. But it turned out to be a fox cub that had been taken as prey by the buzzards. So maybe Niall might have something to say on that. Maybe it was attacked by a buzzard. I don't know. But certainly foxes can carry their young. That is true. Yes.
Yes, buzzards, as you say, now they will take young foxes. The area in question where Gustavo saw it, I know that buzzards do occasionally appear overhead. It wouldn't be the main area for them. But normally what they would do, of course, especially at this time of year, something as small as a fox cub, they could carry it away and they'd probably want to take it back to their nest. So it is a possibility, but I would have expected that the buzzard would probably have carried it away. Certainly it could be that the cub was injured outside, or perhaps something happened to it in the park. Maybe it was ill already. The parent may have carried it, but then when it realised there was no hope for it, or that it had died, it would have probably just left it there at that point, because once the cub was dead, the parent, it's not that it would lose interest, but it would realise that it wasn't worth the investment anymore. That's the way the animals, of course, have to look at this. It's very much an investment, and all of her focus then at that stage would be on looking after her surviving cubs and making sure that they would be able to thrive. Now, of course, in a park like that, there are many predatory creatures and scavenging creatures that would feed on it, so it's very possible that a magpie or a crow of some kind would have come over and started feeding on that. It's a good source of food, and they wouldn't have been able to carry it away, unlike a buzzard. So I suspect that may have been the situation. It ate it there on the spot. Could well be something like a rat could have done it as well, as Gustavo suggested, possibly. But that's nature, of course. The protein doesn't go to waste. Other creatures will take advantage of it and use it to feed their own young at this time of year. It's the circle of life.
The circle of life. Indeed. I mean, we were thinking the same thing, exactly. Actually, speaking of the circle of life and the actual music, you know, The Lion King.
Yes.
I don't know if you've seen the movie or the musical.
Oh, yeah,
have you seen the musical?
I have indeed.
You have indeed. Well, actually, they were discussing on LBC this morning. I was listening. They were talking about the fact that maybe the theatres in the West End are going to be opening a little bit later than was expected. And they were interviewing a person who owns some of the theatres and has staged some of the shows. Guess what his name was? Lord Panto. And I thought, I wondered, if you go back far enough, is that where the name pantomime comes from? Anyway, let's move on. Another question from one of our dedicated listeners.
Hello there. This is Jean in Tipperary, and something I've been wondering about with regards to drones.
Hi, my name is Tara, and I live in Killarney.
Changes in bird
I'm
behavior,
an organic
or
garden.
Are birds been affected in any way by the drones? Have there been changes in their behavior? Anything of interest to note? Yeah. Thank you for taking my question.
Thank you, Jean, for sending in your question. Oh, this is one for you, really. Drones. Everybody seems to have one nowadays. You're nobody if you don't have a drone.
Well, you know, I know they're obviously in widespread use now, but people do need to realise that they can indeed have a big effect on birds and on other wildlife, and particularly at seabird colonies. This is a growing problem. We've seen this quite a bit on the Salty Islands, where there's a big gannet colony and a lot of puffins as well. We've seen quite a bit of disturbance there from photographers and videographers who are using drones to fly over those colonies, and it causes the birds to panic and sometimes to desert their nests because they don't know what this is coming from the air. It looks like some sort of a predator. It's very alien to them. And of course, what happens then is when they leave their nests, the eggs can go cold, but also the gulls and the other predators could come straight in and grab the eggs or the young chicks. So it is a big problem. And it's actually been very much in the news recently because just a couple of weeks ago, just earlier this month, I believe, in California, there was an incident where a drone was being flown over a colony of terns, a species called elegant tern, which is a bit like our sandwich tern. It's related to that. They were nesting on a beach in California. A drone flew overhead and crash landed on the beach, and 3,000 eggs were abandoned. The entire tern colony deserted completely.
A real problem.
Completely gone. So people do need to realise it is an offence under the Wildlife Act for anybody to disturb nesting birds, including at seabird colonies, and that includes by flying a drone over them. So people should give them a wide berth. Now, drones are used for surveying wildlife by people who are trained to know what they're doing and are properly licensed. So there's a proper role for that there too. But people who don't have permission and who don't know what they're doing and aren't licensed should stay away from nesting birds, and particularly from seabird colonies. It really is important.
Yeah, but Niall, I mean, if people don't know that there's actually a bird's nest there, or people who aren't as sharp-eyed as you and me don't know that there's a tern colony on the beach and they fly off their drone off to look at the sea or something, and it goes over a whole nesting site that they didn't know was there. I mean, can they be blamed for that? I mean, ignorance is no excuse in law. So, I mean, just because they didn't know doesn't make it any better. So is it a crime in Ireland to do this? And is it against the Wildlife Act? And if so, who penalises them? Well, what is the legal situation?
It is a criminal offence, Aina, indeed, under the Wildlife Act, as you mentioned, and it's the National Parks and Wildlife Service, and indeed on Garda Síochána, who can enforce that law, and there are severe penalties for people who do this. And again, of course, sometimes people might not realise that there's nests there. And of course, what happens then is birds will give a warning. You'll see them sometimes flying up and trying to attack a drone. They'll react aggressively towards it or give distress calls. And at that stage, people should back away. But certainly in places like the Salty Islands, where we've seen a huge problem with this, people are flying drones there deliberately to try and film the gannets and the other seabirds there. So there's no ignorance happening there. People are doing it deliberately, and it's become a big, big issue. And of course, when it comes to drones, there are all sorts of regulations that need to be enforced and followed, not just from the point of view of wildlife, but in terms of civil aviation and all of this as well. There's also issues around trespass and privacy and all of these other areas. So it's a legal minefield, and it's something I think in Ireland needs more regulation and more enforcement of these laws. It really is important. It's a new technology. A lot of the laws that govern this are quite old and out of date. Mm. So for example, the Wildlife Acts, when they were first brought around, it started in 1976. It was long before anyone would have thought there'd be some sort of personal drone that someone could fly over them. Now, there have been updates and amendments since then, but the law still takes a while to catch up with reality.
Okay, you can get in touch with the programme by texting 51551, or you can email mooney@rte.ie.
Email mooney@rte.ie. Take a look at our website, rte.ie/mooney.
Now, musical moments from morning tonight is the title of pianist Finian Collins' concert, which opens the newly named Dublin International Chamber Music Festival in Farmley House next Thursday, June 17th. Finian's hour-long recital evokes the sounds and colours of a given day from morning into the afternoon and evening and then on into the night. And we're delighted to say that Finian is with us. So let's go over now to Studio 8 and say hello to Finian. Finian!
Thank you very much, Derek. It's wonderful to be here on the programme. And I think it's my first time on The Mooney Goes Wild and to perform something with a connection to nature.
Mm-hmm.
And to remind listeners also that on Thursday they can tune in to the Dublin International Chamber Music Festival and see a full programme of pieces which I will perform at Farmley House on Thursday mm-hmm. evening at 7:30 p.m. as part of that festival, and Musical Moments, it's called, from morning to night. And yes. in that programme, there are several pieces which have birdsong and notations of nature. And in this piece that I'm going to play now by Amy Beach, the American composer, she depicts the song of the hermit thrush, mm-hmm. which she notated when she was staying at the McDowell colony in New Hampshire, exactly 100 years ago. So I'm sure Anna and Niall will be fascinated to hear how the hermit thrush is depicted on the piano. And Dr. Collins as well, listening at home. So this is A Hermit Thrush at Morn by the American composer Amy Beach.
Oh, that was absolutely beautiful. Are you familiar with the hermit thrush, Niall Hatch?
I am. It's one of the most beautiful bird songs in the world, for my money. It's a species that's quite widespread in North America. So people in Canada, United States and in northern Mexico would know this bird very well. Its name, hermit thrush, comes from the fact that it's very shy. It's hard to see. It creeps around in the undergrowth, but that song is instantly recognisable. And it's a bird that looks very like our song thrush. It's speckled on the front, brown on the back, a little bit smaller, but a similar kind of lifestyle. But the reason why so many musicians like this bird is that the intervals between its notes, they're very like the intervals in the scales that are used for human music. So a lot of birds, when they're singing, it has no relation to human musical notation and the sort of mathematical formulae we use to divide up the scale and the vibrations and all of this. But with the hermit thrush, it can actually be written down as musical notation because they're pure tones. And that's why it has inspired poets and composers and all of these people who are very into natural world and all of this music. And I could definitely hear it there in that gorgeous piano playing. It sounded absolutely magical.
Finian is wonderful, isn't he?
Oh, very, very nice. Such a nice guy as well. We were chatting to him earlier. He's
yeah,
a lovely guy.
Aina, did you enjoy that?
I mean, thrushes have lovely songs. Even our own two thrushes, our mistle thrush and our song thrush, are some of the nicest birds. Now, I've never heard the hermit thrush, not being so lucky as Niall, although I did hear the nightingale thrush when we were over in Poland. And again, the wonderful liquid songs and sounds of these. So it's great the way they inspire people to write music about it. Not like the cuckoo, which is only two notes and it's included in lots of music. But to get the thrush and so beautifully played as this. Sure, I'm nearly in ecstasy. I'm hardly speaking to you, Derek. It was lovely.
It was lovely indeed. And if you want to hear more of that, Musical Moments from Morning Tonight can be heard at Farmley this Thursday, next Thursday, June 17th. More details on our website, rte.ie/Mooney.
Email mooney@rte.ie.
Visit the website anytime you like, rte.ie/Mooney. Let's head to County Cork now and say good evening to Jim Wilson. Hello, Jim.
Good evening, Derek. How are you doing?
I'm very good. Whereabouts are you?
I am out in the beautiful and wonderful Harper's Island Wetlands Nature Reserve in the heart of the harbour. It's really, really beautiful day. One of the hottest, I think, probably the hottest here, 25, 26 degrees.
Wow.
Middle of summer, sun is starting to go down in the west. I'm looking out over the wetlands and it's you know, Harper's, we've discussed before, it's been on the show as a topic, mainly for the wetland birds. But this time of year, it's very, very quiet for the wetland birds because they're all off breeding in up the country and in foreign lands. There's just a few gulls out there taking in the evening sun, plenty of land birds. But for those of us who are nature lovers and like to keep occupied all year round, the summer does provide a great opportunity to turn our attention to creatures which have wings, just like the birds, but are much smaller. And these are the moths. You know, we're well used to the butterflies, and the moths often get bad press. You know, they eat your clothes.
They eat your socks.
Like yeah, eat your socks, exactly. Things like that. But they're a fascinating group, and far outnumber the butterflies, which are the ones that get all the attention. And some people will ask, you know, why would you bother studying moths of all things? I mean, they're dull and boring. They actually are not. They are as colourful, if not more colourful. And there's actually a lot more of them in Ireland than butterfly species. We've got about, I think it's 1,500 species now. And, you know, I think only about 2.5 of them might eat some of your clothes. The rest of them have no interest in eating your clothes. And that actually comes from, you know, when all the clothes we had were made from organic material, cotton and linen, things like that. Of course, now a lot of our clothes is made of plastic, and the moths have no interest in that. And it's not the adults that eat your clothes. It's the caterpillars. Adults don't have teeth, you know, so they're not going to do any damage. But anyway, getting back to Harper's Island and the moths and finding something to do while we're waiting for all the birds to come back for the autumn and winter. And we've been studying the moths here at Harper's Island Wetlands on and off since the early 1990s. I got interested around 1992, which was really when they started studying them here too. So with some help from real experts in Moths Ireland, note that down, folks, Moths Ireland.
We'll put it on the website as well, Jim, just to make sure everybody has it, rte.ie/Mooney. Continue, Jim Wilson.
Brilliant. And the people like Ken Bond and Michael Sullivan have come down and helped us out. I've got a small little trap. It's basic. It doesn't kill them. And as most people know, moths are attracted to light. And one thing you can do for the rest of the summer, and it's great fun for all the family, is in the evening, once it gets dark, I know for the younger kids, you might have to keep them up, but outside lights, you know, porch lights, lights around outhouses, wherever you can find lights around your house, moths are attracted to it. And you can actually start studying them. And now that almost everybody has a mobile phone with a camera on it, you can take photographs of the moths you find. And even if you haven't a clue what they are, you can join the Moths Ireland Facebook page. Again, details on the website. And you can post your photographs. And there are many helpful experts in that group, and they will help you identify them. And I guarantee you, for a lot of you, once you get into it, you know, it can become nearly as addictive, if not more addictive, than bird watching. So we've been doing it here. I was out this morning. We put it out at night. The trap you need a license for from the National Parks and Wildlife Service. But that's if you want to get far more interested. For now, I would suggest, if you want to get started, just, you know, go out after dark, check around the lights, take photographs of anything you find and post them on the Facebook page and find out what you've got. And you're also helping us to find out more about the moths in Ireland. You know, we've an awful lot to discover. New species, believe it or not, of moths are discovered in Ireland almost every year. That's how little we know. It's not that there's new ones turning up all the time, but there's so much area to cover. That it's a fantastic opportunity to even find one that had never been found in Ireland before. So I would suggest you do that. And the moths, you know, some say, you know, what's the difference between a moth and a butterfly?
Mm-hmm.
You know, butterflies fly during the day, moths fly during the night. Well, I'm afraid there are moths that fly during the day. Another one, butterflies always fold their wings vertically above their back. Well, I'm afraid there are moths, the thorn moths. They fold their wings vertically above their back. And in fact, they're all part of what is called Lepidoptera. There's no real major difference. There is one little thing on all moths. It's called a fenaculum. And it's a little spur that joins the forewing to the hindwing. Because like butterflies, moths have four wings, not two. And it kind of hitches them together, whereas all the butterflies don't have that. Everything else is up for grabs. They all overlap. And in fact, when you look at them from a taxonomic, from an evolutionary point of view, the butterflies are like sandwiched between what we call the macro moths, which are generally big, not always, but generally big, and the micro moths, which are generally small. And butterflies are in the middle. And so once you get into it, it's like Christmas Day every morning during the summer, because you go out to the trap. They've been attracted to a light, a little like a light in a butcher shop. But obviously in the butcher shop, they have a little electric wire that kills all the insects. Yes. But it's the same light, but we don't have the electric wires. We don't kill any of them. They end up going into a little box below the light, and they stay there quietly till the morning, and you can take them out. And the vast majority stay perfectly still, and you can photograph them and you can look at them. And then when you're finished, you can pop them back in some nearby vegetation. But it is like Christmas. This morning here, I ended up with over 20 species in the trap. And my trap is the smallest, because maybe I'm lazy, or maybe I'm just not as crazy about studying the moths as some of my friends. Some of them have traps that might catch 300 or 400 moths in a night.
Wow.
And it's amazing, but You open the lid and you don't know what's going to be inside. And the shapes and the colours, I think we've put a few, I've picked out two moths in particular that kind of represent the colourful moths, like the cinnabar moth, which flies by day and by night. And then the buff tip, which looks like a broken piece of twig. Masters of camouflage, a lot of the moths. So again, you never know what you're going to get when you open it up.
It's like a box of chocolates, Jim. You never
like
know what you're going
to get. I'm serious.
And I have to say, the photographs that Jim has sent in are absolutely incredible. So please do have a look on the website. Jim, just you want to mention Moths Ireland once more before we take the last break?
I surely do.
Go ahead.
I mean, since the lockdown, they've gone from 700 followers to 2,000 followers.
Great.
Go on Facebook, join up. If you want to get trapping, then that's a whole other story. But they'll give you all the advice you need. That Moths Ireland. Just Google that or put it in your Facebook search and you'll find them. And you'll have hours of endless fun with moths. So signing off here now, really, from Harper's Island Wetlands. And I'll probably put the trap out again in a couple of days. We'll give them a rest and see what new and interesting and exciting species we come across.
Jim, thank you very much indeed. The details on rte.ie/Mooney.
Take a look at our website, rte.ie/Mooney. Send your wildlife recordings, questions and observations on WhatsApp to 087 708 7031.
My thanks to Niall Hatch, to Aina Nilan, to Jarlath and to Mark. We'll do it all again tomorrow night at 10 p.m. Till then, goodbye!
Take a look at our website, rte.ie/Mooney.
Mooney Goes Wild was produced by Derek Mooney.